This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Malcolm Holine, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, Iran. The anecdotes suggest nationwide protests by young people. The puzzle is, we've had protests at least since 2009, the early Obama first term. However, I'm told the Basiji, the bully boys that the regime has counted on to intimidate young people for decades, the Basiji are either no longer feared, they've been ill-paid, they're not showing up. It's a puzzle. We welcome David Shanker. He's the Taub Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute, Director of the Program on Arab Politics. David, are the Basiji older now, are less prominent in the streets, insignificant? The young don't seem to fear them from the videos that I've seen. Good evening to you, David.
Good evening, John. Good evening, Malcolm. Well, we've seen that the Basiji are not doing what they typically do, which is to come out and really go after the protesters and in such a brutal fashion. It appears to be a qualitative difference in the way they're handling it. And as you said, there's less palpable fear of the Basiji. I don't know what the reason for this is, whether it just permeates the protests are just so widespread and across different societal levels that perhaps these are touching, the discontent is touching the families of the Basijis as well. Hard to say.
Malcolm, you have a question for David.
We have the question of what's happening with the Basiji is and Iran's influence, especially the drain of the demonstrations, et cetera, impacting their client state in Lebanon, where we see Hezbollah still emerge as the largest party, but certainly there's a shift. And we see the greater expressions within the Lebanese people, some of the Christian parties challenging Hezbollah. So what's the most likely political outcome as you see it now, the prospects of any kind of a meaningful change in the making?
Well, it's a good question. I don't want to be, sour on these elections. I mean, Hezbollah and its allies lost. They lost their majority in the parliament. Five of Syria's closest partners didn't get elected, reelected to parliament. This was a big deal. You got 15 Sunni sort of independents elected. This is all great, but they're facing really an uphill battle. And it's not just because Hezbollah has both ballots and bullets, right? It kills its opponents, intimidates them. It goes beyond that. Structurally, you still have some of the very same problems you had before the elections. That is, the Speaker of Parliament will be a Shiite. Well, all the 27 seats in Parliament that go to the Shiites are either held by Hezbollah or Amal, Hezbollah's ally. So who are you going to select other than Nabi Berri, who has been Speaker of Parliament since 1991, I believe? Who are you going to select to be the next Speaker of Parliament? And this is a guy who determines what the legislative agenda is. Then you go on to the government. Perhaps the majority can form a government, but Nasrallah has already said, if you don't form a consensus, there's a chance for civil war, which basically means he's going to send out his goons to go kill or intimidate the majority, the people that don't support Hezbollah that are now the majority in the government. And all this is tied to who the next president of Lebanon is going to be. The parliament elects the president, and the majority may want to choose the Christian that will be president, but Hezbollah will want to have a say in that and will drag this out. So I think for better or for worse, this is probably going to take months, 6 months, or more to get another government.
But if Hezbollah starts to lose political influence, do you think that that raises the risk of an escalation of the violence with Israel? Will they look to divert attention if there's a political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, it's always a possibility. And Hezbollah is Al-Mukawama Islamiya fi Lebanon, the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. Hezbollah has not resisted Israel since 2006. They're building their arsenal and preparing for a war with Israel, but they have not attacked Israel in a serious way in a very long time. And so this goes to a question of raison d'etre. They may choose to do something with Israel, but it's not a great time even for them. Hezbollah's constituents in the south and elsewhere are suffering just like everywhere in the Lebanon, before this financial meltdown that the state is facing, $1 was 1,500 Lebanese lira. Today, $1 is 31 or 33,000 Lebanese lira. It's lost 90% of its value. Some 85% of the Lebanese, including the Shiite, the Lebanese Shiites, Hezbollah's constituents, are below the poverty line. So it's not really a great time for a war with Israel either.
The Shia arc, David, from Iran to the Mediterranean. This is a question to do with the crisis in Ukraine and the worldwide famine. There is a drought around the world. The poor harvests in France, Spain, certainly nothing coming out of Ukraine and Russia to note. India's held back. This is wheat now, but also maize. Is there reporting in the Shia Crescent of shortages, of famine? They derive a great deal from the bread products. This is traditional. Have they worked on substitutes? Is anybody attending to this now, David, or is that too much for the fragile governments?
Well, certainly Lebanon is suffering greatly. And even before, because of the dramatic increase in prices and the fact that the government has no foreign reserves. In Syria, they already had a drought. Certainly they're going to be paying higher prices. In a sort of surprise development, King Abdullah of Jordan has been stockpiling wheat and grain starting a year and a half ago. And so they have 11 months supply of these food products. So they're in pretty good shape. But a country like Egypt, by the way, Jordan gets its grain, I believe, primarily from Romania, which means it's not a problem for them. But a place like Egypt, where it's the largest consumer of bread per capita in the world, and they import, 90-95% of their wheat from Russia and Ukraine, this is disastrous. The price of wheat per ton has gone from $250 to $350, $400. It's ruining their budget, and people can't afford it anymore. We're going to see a lot of angry and hungry people in the region.
Iran, you didn't. Is there any particular reporting about Iran food shortages or drought?
Yeah, that is, in fact, what is driving a lot of the protests that we're seeing right now. It is the combination of the long-term impact of American sanctions, even though the Biden administration really has not put the screws to Iran in terms of enforcing the oil sanctions. But the prices increase, and then the lack of availability because of what's going on in Ukraine and global markets. So, yeah, there's hyperinflation in all these countries, just people can't get these staples for reasonable prices. And this is driving a lot of the popular discontent.
Malcolm, we have a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask you quickly about the buildup in the Red Sea, where we hear IRGC establishing footholds there and shipping arms to Houthis. We know that the new combined maritime task force, which we discussed, that was just created. Do you think that they are, we're leading to a confrontation and naval war in the Red Sea? Do you think that the Western powers are able to disrupt the smuggling? And what more can the U.S. be doing to advance that?
Well, I'm glad that the U.S. finally took a step forward and took the initiative to establish and drive this maritime task force. But we have not done a particularly good job at enforcing the UN arms embargo on the Houthis. The Iranians have been getting missile components and all sorts of weapons to them, both in the South and in the Red Sea. It's just a huge country and very difficult to patrol. But the Houthis and the Iranians have been playing around with drone boats, targeting Saudi ships, the United Arab Emirates ships. Now they're starting to do more patrolling to prevent that from happening, mining of the Red Sea. I think it's a positive first step. I don't think we're headed for a war there, but because right now you actually have a ceasefire that has been in place for the past 2 months. But I think the Houthis are with between Saudi and the Houthis. But I think that that they are looking to take this respite in the fighting to rearm and be in a position if the ceasefire breaks down. So it could become more dangerous. And of course, this doesn't just affect Saudi and Yemen. This is all the shipping that goes through the Suez Canal, which is oil and food for everybody in the world.
David, final question very quickly right now. Would you characterize the Syrian situation with the Russia redeploying or withdrawing? Would you say that it was more or less brittle than it was when Russia was ensconced in providing, augmenting the regime? We just have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I wouldn't overstate it. I think Russia has withdrawn some of its Wagner mercenary forces, but still has 40 fixed-wing aircraft. Maybe we'll see a little bit of a renaissance of the opposition to Assad, but I think really people have been enervated by 11, 12 years of fighting and the slaughter. Yeah, the Russians have to do better and rationalize their increasingly scarce resources. And that may have an impact on Syria over time.
David Shanker, the top senior fellow, Washington Institute, Malcolm Hoenlein, Conference of Presidents. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.